The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Garter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. So we finished up both of the main themes for the month, and I'm going to run through some other articles that are of interest that I thought would be interesting to you. One is a regular feature called Ramblin' Man, and this month's article is called The Pig Crew. Most mornings in Richland, the place to be is a diner inside the local Piggly Wiggly, where a cast of regulars ponders life's great questions over a hearty country breakfast. Collared Man pipes right up. "Look here," he says, leaning over a country diner table, fixing me with a serious gaze. "We talk about important stuff every day, big stuff like, how do they get the different colored stripes of toothpaste inside the toothpaste tube? Do you know? Have you ever asked yourself that question?" Appreciative murmurs rumble around a pair of red and white tables, jumbled with coffee cups, plates of eggs, munched on biscuits, and crunched on bacon. Seven or eight men crowd around like an Eastern North Carolina version of the Last Supper. There's a lot of head nodding, a fair number of sheepish grins. "We talked about that for 3 or 4 days," Collared Man says, until we finally looked it up on the computer. "Mysteries of the world," intones another gray-bearded fellow, for whom for the moment I only know as Sunday school teacher. "That's what we struggle with here." These fellows do their best to stifle grins, but the laughter comes quickly, hoots and hollers that jostle coffee and turn over at least one packet of strawberry jelly. Collared Man's real name is Wayne Barbie, I learn. He's a contractor who now works in water systems and is indeed known for growing nearly about the best greens in Onslow County. He's also known for his status as a longtime member of one of the most prestigious, sought-after, heck, even elite, social and cultural clubs in the region, the early morning, two-table gathering of regulars at the Piggly Wiggly Diner in downtown Richlands. This is the scene, right much exactly, 7 days a week at the diner inside the grocery store. The Pig, it's called, and every day but Sunday. Breakfast starts promptly at 5:30 a.m. It opens at 6 on Sundays, despite the fact that regulars might be pecking on the front plate glass window 15 minutes earlier. The lunch counter at the Pig is no slouch. It's a cornucopia of chicken pastry and beef tips and pork chops and barbecue, plus barbecued chicken on most Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays, and fried chicken every day. But it's the country breakfast that defines the place, and not only because of the food. This group gathers every morning in two shifts, early and late. They're retired farmers, bankers, road pavers, and school teachers. The men talk fishing and hunting and sports and politics. They check on each other's families. They remember the old times when most of them were growing up around Richlands, cruising the loop around the old Toot and Tell at Drive-In Diner. They remember hanging out of the car windows, hollering at girls, and then drifting back to the parking lot at the Pig to lean on warm car hoods and talk about fishing and hunting and sports and politics. Well, maybe not politics. Not quite yet. And even today, not everywhere. "Down there is the politics table," Barbie explains, nodding toward the far end of the gathering, not 6 feet away. "On this end, we talk deer and hunting and farming and toothpaste. And they lay it on thick, like old friends do. A couple of weeks ago in Sunday school," Carl Brown tells me, leaning close like he's sharing a secret, "we started lessons in the Old Testament, and Jim here asked me to be a reference. That would be Jim Reifinger, a.k.a. Sunday school teacher. He said he needed someone with first-hand knowledge of the times," Brown continues, "so you can see the kind of people you hang out with here. I don't know where I went wrong." Let me tell you what's on the breakfast menu at the Pig. There's country ham, bacon piled up like timber on a logging deck, two kinds of link sausage, smoked and fresh, scrambled eggs with cheese, scrambled eggs without cheese, plain grits, cheese grits, potato wedges, biscuits and gravy, and cooked apples. There's more, but I'm too hungry to pay closer attention. I've been advised to forego the plate breakfast and put in an order for a Merle bowl, a large cup of grits, eggs, cheese, with a choice of bacon or fresh sausage. It's named for one of the ancestors of Richland's Sylvester family, owners of the Piggly Wiggly and caretakers of its 65-year-old Mystique. Who in their right mind would turn down a Merle bowl? The food is very good, but there's a different sort of sustenance being served up at the Pig, and it's no less palpable than the scent of sausage on a hot flat top. Every morning there's a sort of communion set on those red-top tables. It feeds the soul as much as the body. I've wandered into who knows how many country diners, and what strikes me deeply is how much they have in common, and how wonderfully unique each one is, too, with its own vibe and cast of characters and vocabulary. Merle bold, indeed. Curiously, while Piggly Wiggly's are mostly known as hyperlocal, hometown grocery stores, the chain was originally lauded for its groundbreaking, highly modern approach that changed grocery shopping forever. Founded in Memphis in 1916, Piggly Wiggly was the first grocery store where customers moved through the aisles, pushing carts and choosing their own products. Up until then, shoppers typically handed over a list to an old-fashioned store clerk who assembled and bagged the goods. It's an innovation that very well might rival the invention of striped toothpaste. The next time I'm in Richmond, I might ask these fellows what they think about that. For the moment, though, I dip a big spoonful of my Merle bowl, sit back, and enjoy the show. I recall a conversation I had last night, chatting with John Hayden Sylvester, whose grandfather opened the Richland Piggly Wiggly in 1959, and who now helps the family run Piggly Wigglies across a sizable chunk of eastern North Carolina. "We can't do what the mega chains do," Sylvester said thoughtfully. "They have resources we don't have, so we have to offer something they can't." At the Pig, a cross-section of eastern North Carolina shows up every day in overalls and Sunday suits, work boots and fishing duds, to check on their neighbors and to find out who's getting what on soybeans and ask about your mama's cataract surgery. Looking around this morning, I don't see a soul who would disagree with Sylvester. Mission accomplished. Let's continue with the food theme and move to the food and feast section of the magazine. This one is from Oxford. It's All Rise. A Granville County restaurant continues what its owners started in their home kitchen, a legacy of strong hands, local support, and delicious bread. And this reader is very much of a fan of this restaurant. Mitchell Dosa pulls a 50-pound bag of flour off a stack at Strong Arm Baking Company. As the restaurant's baker, Dosa will use another 6 bags of flour to mix dough for 400 loaves of bread. Outside, it's dark and quiet on this Friday evening in downtown Oxford. Inside, the bakery is humming. Friday is the busiest production day of the week. The pastry chefs will make hundreds of butter croissants and chocolate chip sea salt cookies and dozens of the bakery's much-loved apple bourbon cake for Saturday. And don't forget about Dosa's bread baking marathon. Strong Arm's long production time inspired the bakery's name. When you hear or see the word bakery, we don't want you to think about frou-frou cupcakes, says founder Julia Blaine, who started the bakery in 2014 with her husband Thomas. We want you to think about the fact that this beautiful loaf of bread was made by someone's hand. It is not magically created by machines. It's all done by the loving hands of really hard-working people. When Dosa is finished, his loaves of 10-grain sourdough, focaccia, and ciabatta will be loaded into vans and a box truck for delivery to 2 dozen coffee shops and 2 farmers markets. Then, a half dozen other drivers will deliver the breads, plus spinach quiches, kale Caesar salads, bolognese pasta, green chili pimento cheese from a weekly porch drop menu to hundreds of customers across the Triangle area. Finally, there's the bakery itself. A steady stream of friends and neighbors come in to enjoy a cup of coffee and a cinnamon toffee buttermilk muffin, or maybe a dark chocolate or spinach and cheese croissant. Thomas and Julia met in high school in Granville County. One pined for the other, but they aren't saying which one. They ended up together in their 20s. Julia worked in other people's bakeries and Thomas in land management. Eventually, Thomas built a wood-fired brick oven in their backyard, and Julia started baking bread to sell at a farmer's market on her days off. The couple started Strong Arm out of their Granville County home in 2014. They made dough in the sunroom. Occasionally, customers stopped by their backyard to pick up finished loaves. Before they had a kitchen door that led outside, Julia and Thomas passed loaves to each other through a window. They were ecstatic when they were able to hire a high schooler to wash dishes on Saturday morning so they didn't have to come home from the markets to a full sink. In 2017, they bought the 1890s building on Main Street that would become their production kitchen and storefront. Since then, Strong Arm Baking has evolved beyond what Julia and Thomas originally envisioned. The couple's home operation transformed into a busy business that now has about 70 employees. Some of those workers, including an engineer who designs the porch drop delivery routes across five counties, a retired teacher who runs their stand at the Eno River Farmers Market, and the mayor of Franklinton, who is a delivery driver, started out as devoted customers. Despite the growth, the restaurant's ethos of hard work hasn't wavered. There are still long nights and long and days spent hauling bags of flour, baking bread, and making meals that people travel from around the county and beyond to try. But now, the Blaines have a few more helping hands. And if you're interested in finding more about Strong Arm Baking Company, they're on Main Street in Oxford, and you can find their information on them on their website at strongarmbaking.com. I highly recommend them. Next up is Homegrown Harvest. Decades ago, a Dutch family put down roots in eastern North Carolina. Today, their produce fills greenhouses and fields across Beaufort County. In a greenhouse that peddles in produce, Tom Van Stalenduin describes the ideal tomato, juicy but not watery, no mealiness in the meat, perfectly sandwich size, and never refrigerated. Tom's father, Bill, 91, says that growing a good tomato and most other produce is an art form he learned from his flower farming family. The Van Stalenduins immigrated from Holland in the 1930s to the Dutch community of Terra Sierra near Bellehaven. From age 10, Bill spent his summers clipping gladiolus. Eventually, he managed a local farm and started a family. Five of his six sons went into agriculture, including Tom, who set up his own shop in Pinetown in 2000 with a greenhouse and a small produce stand manned by Bill. As the business grew, Petals and Produce added locations in Washington and Bath, and now, in addition to flowers, offers a wider selection of local produce, including collards, strawberries, asparagus, and tomatoes, available all year round thanks to a greenhouse boiler. So good that Tom jokes that they're actually the fruit that tempted Adam and Eve into sin. Today, Tom's wife, Heather, and their daughter in tow, their daughter-in-law, Taylor, managed day-to-day operations along with Elfigo Morales, an employee and honorary family member who's integral to maintaining the crops. The produce and the family name is in good hands. And for more information about Petals and Produce, check out their website at petalsandproduce.square.site. New dish on the block. In the 1960s and 70s, neighborhood playdates were a chance for one food writer to try new flavors and discover that food with friends tastes a little sweeter. When I was growing up, there was something special about being at a house other than my own. At home, going to bed was mundane, but at a friend's house, it was a sleepover that ended with pancakes. In my yard, a sprinkler was only there to water the grass, but next door, it was our own personal water park that preceded a homemade chicken salad sandwich. Sunday afternoons spent with friends after church were marked with the scent of pot roast in their mom's slow cooker. At other people's homes, I wasn't asked to unload the dishwasher, and I got to experience new home-cooked meals. On summer weeknights and Saturday afternoons, I could often be found at the Becknell's house down the street. Bob and Adeline Becknell had five kids, three boys and two girls. Their yard could hold upward of 15 kids, plus two to four adults smoking cigarettes and catching up on whatever it was that adults talked about. At some point during each gathering, Adeline, Mrs. Becknell to us kids, would appear with her jet black bob, haircut, Peter Pan collared shirt, and pressed cotton capris, carrying a tray of cups and a pitcher of the best sweet tea I'd ever tasted. Crafting her sweet tea must have been an art. I've long debated which brand of tea bags she used. How long would she steep the tea? How much sugar did she add, and when did she add it? Her secret could have had something to do with the gallon Tupperware pitcher that she used, with its tannin-stained interior and vacuum-sealed top. I recently visited Adeline, and after hours of reminiscing, I asked her about her sweet tea recipe. All I know is it went through a lot of sugar over the years, she recalled. Maybe that's why my childhood memories of running from house to house in Greensboro are so sweet. And now from the house and home section is Earth and Abode. In the 1970s, a chemistry professor built a house into a hill to promote a sustainable lifestyle. A group of friends has transformed his habitat into a modernist marvel that still pays tribute to the surrounding landscape. For almost two decades, landscaper Andy Brookmeyer rode his bike past the habitat near Asheville's Montford neighborhood. Craning his neck to see beyond the lot's mature trees, he marveled at the unconventional home built into the hillside. Its distinct slanting roofline and bunker-like south-facing side were the only parts visible from the street. What's beneath that roof, he wondered. In March of 2020, Andy was delighted to find out that the home was for sale, and he immediately called his closest friends, Andrew and Emmy Kahn. Growing up together in New Mexico, Andy and Andrew had always admired Taos's off-the-grid earth shelters, or earth ships, that utilized passive solar technology and wind power. In 2003, Andrew married Emmy, a UNC Asheville graduate who had studied environmental biology and ecology, and the three kindred spirits joined forces to buy and renovate rental houses, slowly breathing new life into old Asheville homes. Now presented with the opportunity to buy and restore Asheville's own earth shelter, Andy recalls that there was no convincing any of us that we wouldn't buy the house. Plus, the timing was perfect. Emmy and Andrew, whose education and jobs had taken them and their two middle school-aged children to Seattle, needed an Asheville landing pad, a place to call home when they came back for annual extended visits. Today, as Andy, Andrew, and Emmy gather around the kitchen table in what is now their own modernized earth shelter, conversation often turns to Lloyd Remington, the UNC Asheville chemistry professor who built the approximately 1,800-square-foot habitat in 1977 during the Cold War. Sustainability was Remington's main goal. By building his home underground, he could guard against the wind chill and climate extremes. In the attic space, which Andy first spotted years ago from the street, a six-foot passive solar feature runs from the home's west end to east ends. Inside that tube, the air is being warmed, Andy explains. Once it reaches a certain temperature, the warm air circulates throughout the house. Or, on a summer day, you can turn on a fan to blow the heat out. Remington cut no corners. He built his home to stand the test of time. Looking up at the ceiling from the kitchen table, Andy points out the precast mast of steel-reinforced concrete, 4 feet wide by 40 feet long. It was probably laid in there with a crane, similar to a parking deck with multiple levels, Andy says, like Lego blocks fitting together. Remington, who taught a survival course as part of the Civil Defense program, also figured that his new home's underground thermal protection would provide shelter in case of a nuclear crisis. Remington installed steel doors with no windows, expanded mesh webbing, and gates 2 feet out, Andy says. From a world's falling apart perspective, he was ready for everything. But from a warmth and welcoming perspective, the home needed work. Emmy remembers the first time she walked through. It felt like a church kitchen from back in the 80s with all the vinyl flooring and panel cabinetry. To modernize and add warmth to the home's interior, the trio started with the kitchen and the living rooms, which were separated by a half wall. Emmy had the idea to replace the wall with a kitchen island and dining room table. Those features created an epicenter, she said, and that started to delineate intimate zones for living. Next, they removed the bunker-like iron fixtures that separated the living room from the courtyard and replaced them with sliding glass doors that opened to Andy's landscaping. Across the street, every day, dozens of people walk the UNC Asheville walking trails, he said. I wanted to plant things like rhododendron and oaks that would complement the forest. He also built stone walls and pathways throughout the property that would define the lot itself and create intimate spaces for conversation. In the living room and the primary bedroom, walls of windows make Emmy and Andrew feel like they're communing with nature. Looking out toward the south, there's a soft light cascading in from the solar attic, and you have a beautiful view of the lot's mature trees, Andrew says. Emmy likes to slide open the living room doors to hear the birds as she sips her morning coffee. This house proves that you can be conscientious about your environmental footprint while having something that's quality built, she says. It stood the test of time, and it feels good that we were able to give it new life. I'll try to describe some of the pictures for you in this. So the front of the house has concrete, it looks like. In 1977, Lloyd Remington built the habitat using more than 200 tons of concrete to protect the home against extreme weather and the potential threat of a nuclear war. So you have, it appears to be a one-story house when you see it from this angle because you can't see the rest of it. And you can see where they've replaced a lot of the iron doors with sliding glass windows. And there's some spheres that are decorating, and there's some flower boxes and native plants that are growing in Asheville. Inside, says owner Emmy Kahn used her knowledge of sustainable design to add interior elements that complement Remington's original vision for the habitat, a solar roof feature heats and cools the home and fills it with natural light. And to describe this solar feature, it looks like it has a wooden frame, a dark wood frame, and then there's opaque panels behind there allowing light to come in. And they've decorated the house with more sort of mid-century type of furnishings. And then the kitchen has, they added the dining room table and a banquette on one side of the dining room table and chairs on the other. And an updated the kitchen. They don't have a before and after picture, but it's quite, it's very modern and sleek looking, and but yet warm, and certainly someplace that you'd like to be. The next article in the House and Home section is called Hope Blooms. Tended by a mother and son, a local flower farm and delivery service has sown seeds of joy and positivity in the Triangle area. At a small flower farm in Chapel Hill that abuts the properties where she and her son live, Rebecca Sorensen adds white peonies to a floral arrangement with status, seeded eucalyptus and wheat. Next to her open-air studio, her son Ramey lays down sheets of black fabric to prevent weeds from growing in a flower bed where he will plant dianthus and snapdragons. Rebecca and Ramey, who has autism and epilepsy, started Blossom in 2016 to encourage Ramey's independence and connection to their community. He works on the farm daily and delivers flowers each Wednesday. When you bring people flowers, their response is always joy, Rebecca says. So here's this young man, he's taking you flowers, and the response that he gets from the community is, "You're amazing, these are beautiful." As a result of his work, Ramey has been able to stop taking anxiety medication, and in the years since founding the business, he's only had one seizure. What we really want to promote is not just our beautiful, locally grown product, but also the message that just because someone has a disability doesn't mean they don't have something beautiful to give back to the world, Rebecca says. Each week, Ramey delivers that message door-to-door, bouquet by blooming bouquet. And if you'd like to know more about Blossom, you can look up their website, beautifulblossom.com. And Blossom is spelled B-L-A-W-E-S-O-M-E, beautifulblossom.com. And now we'll turn to the last section of Hidden History, 50 Things You Didn't Know About North Carolina. The history of the Old North State is peppered with little-known facts and fascinating tidbits. More than ephemera, these are details that add color and texture to the story of our state. One giant leap for womankind. When Georgia Ann, tiny, Broadwick, lacked in height, standing little more than 4 feet tall, she more than made up for in moxie. After she saw Charles Broadwick's famous French aeronauts perform at the State Fair in Raleigh in 1907, she decided, "That's for me." Broadwick ultimately adopted the diminutive 15-year-old and named her the Doll Girl. She made her inaugural jump from a hot air balloon at the North Carolina State Fair in 1908. Tiny went on to become a giant in the aeronautical world. She's remembered as the first woman to parachute both from an airplane into a body of water and is often credited as the inventor of the ripcord. During her lifetime, she made more than 1,100 jumps. Home field disadvantage. In 1942, the location of the Rose Bowl game between Oregon State College and Duke University was relocated to Durham from Pasadena, California, because of fears of a Japanese attack. Pearl Harbor had occurred just a month earlier. Due to the demand for tickets, UNC Chapel Hill and North Carolina State College of Agriculture and Engineering stepped up to provide additional bleacher seats. You could say that NBC announcer Bill Stern was the Beavers' 12th man that day. He asserted that Duke could beat the Beavers by throwing 11 helmets on the field, a comment that caught the ear of Oregon State players. The angry Beavers beat the undefeated Blue Devils 20-16. Born in Bostic? Folks in Rutherford County make a strong case that Abraham Lincoln was not, in fact, born in Kentucky, but rather in a log cabin near Bostic. They're so convinced of that, they opened a museum dedicated to the evidence that they've collected over the years. All That Glitters. America's first gold rush was triggered by a young boy playing hooky from Sunday school. In 1799, Conrad Reed decided that he'd rather go fishing than recite Bible verses. As he dipped his line into Little Meadow Creek in rural Cabarrus County, he spotted a large glittering rock. His father was less than impressed with the 17-pound specimen that his son lugged home. Dad used it as a doorstop for 3 years before showing it to a local jeweler who had an instantaneous eureka moment. Before long, Little Meadow Creek became the epicenter of a gold rush that preceded California's by almost a half century. Echoes of a Dream. On November 27, 1962, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. addressed an audience of 1,800 in the gymnasium at Booker T. Washington High School in Rocky Mount. It was one of the first times he used the phrase, "I have a dream," and included rhetorical devices and language that were further refined and ultimately became part of his famous speech during the March on Washington on August 28, 1963. Well, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.